Good morning, everyone. This is a very effective microphone. I'll stand back just a little bit. I'm Eileen O'Connor. I'm a partner at Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman LLP, and it is my pleasure to welcome you this morning to the Federalist Society's Tax Policy Conference entitled Our Nation's Founding Principles and Our Tax Code, Consistent or in Conflict. I will admit those are actually my words, and the content of the conference is pretty much the result of my experience over the past 30 years as I have been engaged in tax practice and have watched clients struggle with the Internal Revenue Code, how to comply with it, seen other people try to figure out how to get out from under it, and all the time trying to weigh what the Internal Revenue Code does with what an Internal Revenue Code really ought to do. It is my great privilege to be an American citizen, and unlike most American citizens, or many American citizens at any rate, I realize what a great privilege it is because I was raised by a woman who was born and raised overseas in another country, in a different culture. And as I was growing up, I was able to observe through her eyes the wonder of America, the wonder of the country that our founding fathers created for us, and through the effort and sacrifice of so many has been bequeathed down through the generations to us. A government that is authorized by the consent of the governed. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I was out in Southern California last week, and a partner of mine who was born and raised in California and still lives there, as we were looking around at this beautiful, beautiful area in San Diego, he said, "Yep, I'm spoiled, I know I'm spoiled, and I like it that way." And I think that's the way that that we all are. We all are spoiled, whether we know it or not, and we need to like it enough in order to be able to do what's necessary to keep it that way. My father used to have a saying. When he'd see something that annoyed him, he'd say, "There ought to be a law. You know, there ought to be a law against it." Well, maybe there should and maybe there shouldn't. There are sometimes too many laws. And sometimes if there's not a good reason for there to be a law against something, you can influence people to do it or not do it by putting it into the Internal Revenue Code. And that's what we have seen a lot of in the past, well, for as long as I've been watching, which is well over 30 years, and even before then. The 16th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified in 1913, and here's what it says. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration. That's pretty much all it says. But those of you who are engaged in tax practice know that the Internal Revenue Code is not only the embodiment of the rules for what revenues must be paid into the federal treasury, but also for lots of different things. And we're going to talk about quite a few of those today. Some of those different things that we're not going to talk about include, did you realize, for example, that the Internal Revenue Service needs to have experts on what constitutes an alternative fuel? That the Internal Revenue Service has to have experts on what constitutes political speech? The Internal Revenue Service has to have a lot of experts, most of whom we will not talk about today, but we are going to talk about some of the major areas in which the Internal Revenue Service gets involved that maybe there would be a better way to do that. Our first panel is about health care, how our tax laws affect how health care in our country is paid for and delivered. Our moderator is Professor Amy Monahan of the University of Missouri Law School, and she will introduce to you her panelists, Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute and Robert Helms of the American Enterprise Institute, Mark Pauley is still on your programs, and he's still on this slide because although he couldn't be with us today because of a death in the family, he still has some very valuable scholarship. And being a professor, it's all on his website, and I would encourage you, if this area interests you, to go there and read some of what he has written. Our second panel today is about charity, whether and if so how our tax laws affect charitable activities, religious institutions, and free speech. Our moderator for that panel is Matthew Vadim, who I will introduce when we get to that panel. His panelists, whom he will tell you about, are Lee Goodman, Kevin Hassan, and Ann Neal. And our third and final panel, which will begin about 1 o'clock, is about tax expenditures, which we will discuss. We will define tax expenditures, the wisdom and efficacy of using the Internal Revenue Code to implement social policy. I'll moderate that, and our panelists will be Professor Lily Batchelder of the New York University School of Law, Leonard Berman of the Urban Institute, and Stephen Enten of the Institute for Research on the Economics of Taxation. Without further ado, then, let me turn it over to our first panel. Our moderator is Amy Monahan, who is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri-Columbia School of Law. Ms. Monahan joined that faculty in 2004. Before she joined the faculty there, she had taught at Notre Dame and had also practiced law with Sidley Austin, LLP, in Chicago. If the panelists will first come, we'll go ahead and come up here.
First of all, thank you to Lee and the Federalist Society for organizing this conference and having me here today. I'm really pleased that at this conference there's a panel on how the tax code affects healthcare, financing, and delivery. I think it's a fundamental issue, and I think all too often it doesn't receive enough attention. Before I turn things over to our two panelists, I'm just going to give some brief introductory remarks. So the topic of our panel today is how tax laws affect how healthcare is paid for and delivered. And as many of you in this room probably know, the answer is that it affects it fundamentally. The way we finance and deliver healthcare is really tax code driven, at least with respect to non-elderly Americans. I'm not going to go into the history of how we got where we are because Bob is going to cover that. But the regulatory system that we have in place now is one that few, if any, would defend in terms of regulatory theory. That said, it does have some benefits, which I'll talk about in a moment. So first, let me just give you a brief summary of where we are today for those that might not be engaged in the world of the taxation of employer-provided health insurance. So we have a very significant tax preference given to employer-provided health insurance. Employers can deduct the cost of providing health insurance to their employees just as they can deduct any other reasonable compensation expense. Nothing special about that. But unlike other compensation that employers pay to employees, the amount that employers spend on employee health care is excluded from the employee's income for both federal income tax purposes and payroll tax purposes. So we have a very significant tax preference there. Getting health care benefits from your employer is a much more advantageous arrangement than getting cash wages, because cash wages, of course, are taxed. As a result, not only do you have a tax preference, but it also encourages employers to contribute to the cost of the health care that they provide for employees. So not just set up a group plan, but actually contribute to it instead of paying their employees cash wages. There are other benefits as well that I'll briefly talk about. As we all probably know, the benefits that are paid from an employer-provided plan are excluded from the employee's income when paid, right? So if they reimburse your hospital bill, that's not included in the employee's income. Employers can adopt a cafeteria plan under Section 125 of the tax code to allow employees to pay their share of premiums for employer-provided health insurance on a pre-tax basis. So the employer's contribution is excludable from income. The employee's contribution can be paid on a pre-tax basis if a cafeteria plan is in place. You all also probably know that through a cafeteria plan, you can set up a health care flexible spending account that allows you to pay out-of-pocket health care expenses on a pre-tax basis. Now, those are subject to various restrictions, the biggest one being the use-it-or-lose-it rule, right? You have to pre-commit to an amount that you set aside in your flexible spending account, and you either have to spend it or your employer gets that money back. So things are pretty good for employees that receive health care from their employer. Basically, everything can be tax-free. That stands in stark contrast to individuals who either do not receive health care through their employers or who aren't employed, right? Individuals who are outside of the employer-provided health care arena. If you purchase health insurance outside of the employment context, you cannot deduct its cost unless you're self-employed. If you are self-employed, you can deduct 100% of the premiums. Individuals now can also set up health savings accounts, which do allow limited deductions for contributions to health savings accounts. I think Michael is going to talk in more detail about health savings accounts and how they work and how they might be reformed. A health savings account requires, among other things, an individual to set up a high deductible health plan and be covered only by that high deductible health plan. But the premiums associated with that plan cannot be paid on a pre-tax basis unless your employer is offering it or you are self-employed. And finally, individuals can deduct their out-of-pocket medical expenses only if they exceed 7.5%, only to the extent they exceed 7.5% of the individual's adjusted gross income for the year. So significantly limited deductions for out-of-pocket health care expenses. So the bottom line is, essentially, anyone that has access to employer-provided health coverage usually takes it if they want health insurance because the tax code so skews the economics of that decision in favor of employer-provided coverage. So with this very clear preference for employer-provided coverage, there are advantages. One is that the majority of non-elderly Americans receive their health insurance through an employer. And I shouldn't say that's necessarily an advantage. That's just a result. The other big result is that because, employer-provided coverage is subsidized by the federal government through the tax provisions, we generally think that individuals end up with more health insurance than they would absent the federal tax treatment. Because of the federal subsidy, because of the preference for employer-provided coverage over cash wages, employers offer more generous plans, and employees elect more generous plans than they would absent the federal tax treatment of those benefits. So let me talk briefly about kind of big picture perceived advantages and disadvantages before I turn things over to Bob. The big advantages of this system are advantages of group purchasing. So lower administrative costs. It's much more efficient to purchase insurance as a group rather than individuals. You have lower overhead costs, essentially, load costs for group coverage, which helps to control cost. And perhaps the biggest advantage is the risk pooling function of employer groups. Employers are natural risk pooling groups for the most part, and that helps high-risk individuals to be able to afford coverage they otherwise wouldn't. There's nice kind of natural risk pooling there. And I think the third big advantage that people would name is that it's easy for employees. One concern with insurance purchase on the individual market is that those are tough decisions to make. If you're an individual looking at insurance policies, you have to evaluate a very wide range of factors, try to make decisions about uncertain events. It's a difficult decision. The employer market is easy, right? It might not nicely match your preferences, but it is easy. It's not cognitively taxing to choose an insurance plan between maybe the one that your employer offers, or maybe they offer up to five. It's still a nice limited decision process, and we know from behavioral economics that that can be a benefit as well. The list of disadvantages is longer, and that's probably why we're talking about this today. Disadvantages I would put in two main categories. They're both economic disadvantages and fairness issues. Economically, huge cost associated with the tax preference for employer-provided insurance. I think one of the handouts you got lists tax expenditures. You'll notice employer-provided health insurance is number one on the list. It is the most expensive tax preference item we have in the budget, which is why I think it's so important that we're talking about that today. One thing to note is the handout you have refers only to federal income tax issues. We also lose money in the payroll tax system as well because those benefits are exempt from payroll taxes. So it's a very big expenditure. There's a very big cost to us. And the other big economic disadvantage is the notion that this tax preference encourages overspending in healthcare. There are pressures to elect generous insurance coverage. When people have generous insurance coverage, the rational thing to do is to consume medical care, right? You've paid for it through your premiums. Your plan is likely to have low-cost sharing, so you have a small marginal cost when you decide whether or not to go to the doctor. Maybe one of the classic examples is you think you have the flu, but you're not sure. When you think about whether or not to go to the doctor, who you know probably can't help you, you're evaluating that decision based on maybe a copay of $20. Could be as low as zero. So you might as well go to the doctor. Whereas if you were evaluating that decision based on the full cost of service, you might forego going to the doctor. So there's this idea that, at least with respect to what I'd call discretionary medical services, that the tax preference leads to overconsumption of medical care, and that's not good for anyone. On the fairness side, there are several different issues. It's a deduction, so obviously that is going to benefit those in the highest tax bracket the most. The other side of that is that people with little or no income tax liability receive no benefit from this deduction. And when we think about who we're trying to help or to subsidize, whose behavior we're trying to nudge, if you will, it's probably hard to defend a deduction on those grounds. And I think probably the last fairness issue is simply the disparate treatment. Right? It's very hard to come up with an argument as to why it makes sense to allow people who have the moral luck of working for an employer that offers them health insurance to be able to purchase that on a pre-tax basis, but not allow individuals without that luck to get the subsidy from the federal government. So lots of fairness critiques. So as you can see, the list of disadvantages is significantly longer than the advantages. That isn't to say they necessarily outweigh them. But the result is that there's a great deal of interest in reforming how we tax health insurance. The big question, of course, is which path reform should take. You see some people arguing for leveling up, meaning extend the favorable tax treatment to everyone, don't limit it to the employer context. Others argue for leveling down, take away the preference from employer-provided insurance and put everyone on a level playing field that way. Other proposals, and I would probably argue most proposals, lie somewhere in between. And I think that's what we're going to see today. I think we'll also see today that there are no easy solutions here. First I should say that the tax treatment of health insurance is actually pretty popular today, right, because most people benefit from it. And so there's a lot of political opposition to changing the tax treatment. It's also the case that as we tinker with the tax treatment of health care, we have to contend very directly with how that affects state insurance markets, risk pooling functions of insurance, and uncertain outcomes. So today we're going to hear first from Bob Helms, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's going to talk to us about the history of the tax treatment of health insurance, as well as some possible reform options. As I mentioned, Bob's a resident scholar in health policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's written and lectured extensively on health policy, health economics, and pharmaceutical economic issues. He's widely published and has held various government positions in the healthcare industry. So without further ado, Bob Helms.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. That was an excellent introduction for my talk. I also want to say I'm happy to be here. I've heard about the Federalist Society for years, and I want to particularly compliment you on putting together this session. As I will try to say in my talk, I think this is an area that is greatly misunderstood. I don't know whether misunderstood is the right word. Maybe it's more like ignored in the broader health policy debate and also in the media. And one little just illustration of this is almost every reporter you talk to about tax treatment, they'll write it, use the word tax deduction when we're really talking about the tax exclusion. So I'm on a campaign. My every reporter you talk to, please try to tell them, you know, to use the right word. But anytime you read something in the paper and they talk about eliminating the tax deduction, you should question whether they really mean that or whether they're talking about the exclusion. Anyway, I recently wrote an article about the history, which is going to be published in a Brookings volume that Lynn Berman, you'll hear later, has put together. And in the process of that, I read a number of sort of history books about insurance, and I happened to run across this interesting bit of ancient history. It said, long before the Christian era, it was a custom among the more fluent people in ancient China to pay the doctor as long as they continued in good health. When disability overtook them, the medical man's compensation was stopped. So it was insurance. If his ministrations were unavailing and affecting recovery, the executioner relieved the doctor of his cares. So that's one model of health insurance. I just want to make the point that health policy and even tax policy is certainly in the political debate today. As last I heard this morning, we still have two Democratic candidates. I'm not going to go into the detail of this. There's a lot of information about these plans on the Kaiser family website, Health 08, and so on. I put a couple of them in red. You know, the ones that get the attention is that Hillary is proposing an individual mandate, and Senator Obama is an individual mandate for children. But basically, I think most of the experts in this area think that all of these proposals are still very vague, and the other question is, you know, whoever gets elected, getting something passed is another different issue. So I do have highlighted down here health plan regulations in both the Clinton and Obama plan. Just point out there's a lot of details already in there about various very regulatory proposals that they're proposing for private health insurance. Now, Mr. McCain's proposal is even more vague. There is a group that's been meeting to try to flesh out the details of this. So far, he's proposing to end the tax exclusion, but to give everybody, regardless of income, a tax credit, individuals $2,500 and families $5,000. And then he's recently referred to GAP, or Guaranteed Access Plan. And again, this is something he would work out with the states, to have as kind of a fallback position that people could buy into. He would also allow the interstate purchase of health insurance and so on. There are no sort of official estimates or scorable estimates actually on any of these plans. I should have pointed out the estimates on the Clinton and Obama plans are really the ones that done by the campaigns themselves, not by outside scorers. Now, let me just... my apologies to real economists here, but I just want to highlight what I think we health economists think we know about this market over the years. And that one, while we're talking about a kind of service that a lot of people think is not a normal commodity and so on, we do know that prices in this market matter. They matter to the buyers, they matter to the sellers. We also know that insurance, whether it's public or private, lowers the perceived value, perceived price to the consumer. In other words, we have what's commonly called a moral hazard problem, or increases the volume demanded when people don't pay the full price out of pocket. On the supply side, you have to know that the delivery of health care is very labor-intensive. It's mostly services, but we do have a lot of products and so on that they're always changing, so innovation, investment in innovation and so on is an important issue in this market. And we have large capital investments, particularly in hospitals, nursing homes, and so on, which make quick adjustments more difficult. But what's common about both public and private programs is that almost all the payment policies that we have are open-ended in various ways. I'm not going to talk about Medicare and Medicaid, but they have their own sort of open-endedness. I'm going to talk about tax policy today. But this open-ended policies create strong incentives to increase the spending. In other words, you're spending somebody else's money, and so your incentives to be careful about it are much weaker. The result is what Clark Havikhurst and others have called flat of the curve medicine. In other words, we invest up to a point where the marginal returns are very low and sometimes negative. Now, I want to talk a little bit about history. And the first thing I'm not going to go into all these details, but the period of time starting in the 30s, the 40s, and the early 50s was a period of great change on the medical technology side. Lots of new discoveries, in particular the development of penicillin during use with the troops in World War II and then made widely available right after the war. This really had the effect of allowing a lot of what we now consider to be routine surgery. Before that, it was more difficult to do because you couldn't keep down the infection. So there was major advances not only on the drug side, but also how to do things, procedures, and so on. And so people began to perceive of medical care much differently than they had in the 30s. It looks like I've got a...
Pardon me. Seem to have popped right out of that. I don't know if that's going to happen again or not.
If it comes in, I'll just delete it, okay?
Yeah.
So there were a lot of changes going on the technical side. But what this did for consumers is people, if you go back to the 30s, I made this up, but I read a lot of similar statements in the literature, you know, that in the 30s, it's sort of the average physician could not affect the average condition of the average patient. Now, that statement allows you to say there were lots of examples of innovative things going on in medical schools, even in the 30s. But the perception was, stay out of a hospital. It's a dangerous place. That's where people go to die. And if you went there, you're probably going to get an infection. But that changed even by the 50s. So people began to perceive that medical care can actually do something for you, but it's expensive. So that created a demand for insurance. Meanwhile, just the early parts of insurance really developed in the 30s in what we now call the Blue Cross plans, but were originally organized by these early prepayment plans that started in the Depression because a lot of the hospitals were looking for ways to get payment. And these were organized by the American Hospital Association into the Blue Cross plans. And then the physicians sort of started after that, and that developed into the AMA got involved in that and developed into the Blue Shield plans. So the commercial insurance that we know sort of in the private sector developed sort of after the Blues plans. But the Blues, the AHA and the AMA went to the state legislatures and got a lot of legislation passed that made these nonprofit and exempted them from a lot of state taxes. Now we have World War II coming along, and a big effort to sort of win the war. And this evolved into a massive amounts of sort of economic planning and so on. And so they had these the War Production Board to coordinate production of the materials, intensive government planning and price controls. To control wage and prices, they had really two programs, the Office of Price Administration, which ran the rationing system and price controls and so on. But the National War Labor Board was actually controlling wartime wages. And they had standards. They were serious about this. And they had to deal, when you look at the records, they had to deal with all kinds of questions about people writing in. Can I give this raise or not? Is this allowed? And, you know, what do I do about paying relatives and vacation pays and all kinds of details? It's amazing. So they were actually serious about trying to control wartime wages and also keep down labor strife. In 1943, this board had the issue, what do we do about fringe benefits? And so they sort of adopted the IRS rules, basically said, we have our hands full controlling cash wages, and so we're not going to try to apply the wage controls to fringe benefits, meaning pensions and health insurance. But this was at a time when health insurance was relatively small and inexpensive. But the policy was put into place. And I might add that this War Labor Board also said, for a brief time, they had a version of a tax cap. They said, you know, that these had to be reasonable. They couldn't exceed 5% of wages. Now, after the war, the War Labor Board went away in 1945. So after that, the IRS adopted this same policy, but vacillated a little bit about whether employer-provided health insurance should be taxable or not. And the Congress finally stepped in 1954 and put this into legislation, saying that health insurance provided by the employer was to be excluded from taxable income. Now, this combined, the preference that Amy explained, this combined with this new increase in demand for health insurance to greatly increase health insurance coverage. We also had at the time in the post-war period large increases in both population, women working, and income, all of which tended to increase the demand for health insurance. And this is, if you can actually look at this thing, from 1940, before the war, the people who had hospital benefits increased from 12.3 million to about 180 million, or about almost 90% of the population had insurance of some kind. But this took a particular form. As you can see here, in terms of the millions of people covered by employer groups compared to individual coverage, I mean, the individual market did grow after the war, but the tax policy really gave a reason to push it into the group. But again, Amy's reminder that there are advantages for risk pooling and so on also played a role in this. The tax policy wasn't there, but it was sort of like tax policy provided sort of the fertilizer to have this grow. I don't know whether that's the right analogy, but this is some historical data from the 1960s to 2000 about private group health and benefits as a share of total compensation. It's been growing. And, of course, it took the form, and this also reflects Medicare and Medicaid, but basically you had a major change in the way health care is paid for. Reduction in out-of-pocket payments from almost 60% to less than 20% from 1960 to 2000. Now, I know you're going to debate about the use of tax policy in healthcare. I guess one of my conclusions that I'm trying to convince you of today is that the present tax policy was kind of a historical accident, but it has certainly played a large role in pushing health insurance into the employment sector, but also in a certain kind of insurance that's inefficient. Now, whether we should use tax policy like this, I look forward to the debate at lunch, but I will say I use these figures because they're a convenient statistic that's sort of one number I can point to show that this has grown over time. Now, you have the green bars are really plotting the Treasury Department's estimates, which is similar to what you have in the handout, over time. And as you can see, they've grown. John Shields at Lewin, the Lewin Group, has an alternative estimate where he really includes the effects of payroll taxes and state taxes, and his are almost up to, in 2007, almost up to $250 billion a year. And I will say that since John's earliest estimate of 1998, these are going up yearly over $13 billion a year in tax expenditures. Now, what difference does this, how does this compare to the economy? I've taken just those federal numbers and compared them to their, as you can see, gross domestic product as a percent. The bottom is growing, and is also growing relative to federal tax expenditure as a percent of national health expenditures, but also as a percent of entitlement expenditures in the federal budget. So it's increasing relative to almost anything you put in the denominator. Now, just to, for the economist on the left and the non-economist, I'm trying to illustrate here, so that the effects of tax policy has been to push the demand curve out to a higher equilibrium than it would have been without the point that Amy made again. And another way to sort of use Milton Friedman's analogy about a boiling pot, you have tax policy was one of several factors. Medical technology and income growth, I think, also are effective. But basically, you know, increasing the demand, the intensity, the cost of this, this caused higher prices in both public and private sector, lack of access because people have to, they face higher medical costs and also higher insurance costs, and this creates winners and losers. Now, just to summarize, the effects of tax policy intensified the effects of increases in income, population, and medical technology, expanded the employment-based insurance relative to the individual insurance market, expanded insurance benefits, meaning gave an incentive at the margin for people to have more hospital coverage, more outpatient. Then it went to mental health, dental, drugs. Some people even include exercise programs now. But you, if you can get your employer to do these things, you get it at the tax-free. And another point about the exclusion is the higher your marginal tax rate, the higher is the benefit for this to you. This also reduced cost sharing. There's been some retrenchment of that, but over time you have more, the employer plan covering more of the plan, so it creates more of a moral hazard problem. So it induced a level of higher level of costs, prices, and expenditures, and as said, you know, created winners and losers. Now, let me just turn briefly, and I'll close, about the health reform debate. This is oversimplified, but in my view, you've got sort of three approaches here. The first is you can take a tax reform approach. To me, this is a necessary condition. If the history of this was that tax policy pushed us into an inefficient form of insurance, it seems to me that we've got to change it somehow, maybe put a limit on it or something like a, with a tax cap, to give incentives for people to redesign these plans in, and put more emphasis on value and cost effectiveness. And you could eliminate the tax exclusion, you could put on a tax cap, like was in the 1940s or in, briefly in World War II, or we actually proposed a tax cap in the Reagan, 2 years in the Reagan administration, something I was involved in. Bush had a standard deduction proposal, and now McCain has a tax credit proposal, all of which the last two would eliminate the tax exclusion, but give people a deduction or a tax credit instead. You have, under this system, you would have strong incentives to redesign the health insurance coverage. You'd have more research on cost effectiveness. But the market would then determine which kind of health policy would dominate. And you'd have, I think, more cost-effective options for small business, which is where a lot of the uninsured are now. So I do think this is a necessary but not sufficient condition for effective reform. The alternative, I would say, is the regulatory approach, more administered fee schedules like we have in Medicare, more global budgeting as Hillary proposed in 1993. You'd have mandated benefits like both of the Democratic candidates are proposing. You can mandate coverage for individual employers. You'd have a lot more underwriting restrictions, price controls on insurance, and also both of the plans are talking about mandates on the payout from insurance, which to me is just a form of price controls. The third option is just return to the ancient Chinese model. It has obvious incentives to improve medical outcomes, but I really don't think you'd get much support from the AMA. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Our next panelist is Michael Cannon, who is the Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies. Prior to joining Cato, he served as a domestic policy analyst for the U.S. Senate Republican Policy Committee and is widely published in healthcare policy. Michael.
Thank you, Amy. And thank you, Bob and Eileen. Bob, I want to let you know that I'm on my own campaign to change the way people talk about one aspect of healthcare, and that is I'm trying to, well, not just healthcare, but taxes generally. I'm trying to eliminate from our vocabularies the term tax expenditure. I want to thank Eileen for putting that in quotation marks in your slides. It was not in quotation marks in your slides, Bob. My war against this term has to do with the fact that a tax expenditure is how we describe money that the government leaves with you. We call it spending. It's like tax expenditures are also referred to as subsidies. I don't think you can spend money or subsidize someone unless you actually have that money in your hands and then give it to someone else. And I fear the day that the government begins to consider all of the money that it lets us keep a tax expenditure and decide, well, we're spending it here, let's just spend it somewhere else instead. So anyway, my campaign goes on. I want to thank Amy and Bob for really laying out most of the important issues surrounding tax reform and health care. Amy mentioned, I think, most of the health-related deductions that we've got, the one for employer-sponsored insurance, which is an exclusion. I should change this now. I should put that in quotation marks. There's also an exclusion for money put into a flexible spending account, a health reimbursement arrangement, or a health savings account. These are all accounts that let the individual consumer control the money. None of them really create, or health savings accounts are the only ones that really create ownership because they're the only ones that where you get that tax break for money that you own and can take with you from job to job. And also there's the tax deduction. This one is a deduction for qualified medical expenses in excess of 7.5% of adjusted gross income. And the tables that are in your handouts from the budget that show the revenue loss from the exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance, as Amy mentioned, don't include the revenue loss due to the payroll tax, loss of revenue under the payroll tax. Once you add that in, the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance is about two times the next biggest revenue loser, which is the mortgage interest deduction. Now, I want to talk about that exclusion. Here we go. I got exclusion up there. In terms of how it distorts the prices or the costs that consumers, that workers face when they're making decisions about how much health insurance to buy, where to buy it, and how to pay for their medical needs generally. The exclusion distorts the prices or the costs that workers face in three different ways. First, it distorts the relative cost of health versus non-health expenditures. You got a tax break for employer-sponsored health insurance. That's going to reduce the cost of healthcare spending generally relative to non-health expenditures. Second, it reduces the cost of third-party insurance relative to self-insurance. Because if you decide to get less generous coverage through an employer, your employer makes that decision, and save a little bit of the money, put a little bit of the money you save in premiums aside to help you pay for your medical bills, traditionally, that money you put aside was taxed. So it wasn't a level playing field between those two decisions, between premiums and savings. With health savings accounts and some of those other options, the playing field has been leveled somewhat, but not completely, because it only happens within a narrow range of premiums and deductibles, and it only works for people who purchase a qualified high-deductible health plan that's compatible with a health savings account. And third, the exclusion favors employer-sponsored insurance over other forms of third-party insurance. This could be insurance that you purchase on your own or through a group. And what ends up happening there is, the way that works is, it favors employer-sponsored insurance to such an extent that if you decided to purchase insurance on your own rather than through an employer, depending on your health status and your tax bracket, you could end up paying twice as much for the same or less coverage. Twice as much because you'd be paying higher taxes. So what does this do to our health insurance market? Well, I think that a lot of individuals end up getting stuck with insurance that they don't want, that doesn't meet their preferences. In the 1990s, as a response to the growing cost of health insurance, employers tried to move a lot of their workers into managed care. A lot of their workers didn't like that. Right now, we're seeing a shift toward more cost sharing in order to try to hold down the rising health insurance premiums. And we're probably going to see a similar backlash. I think we are seeing evidence of a similar backlash from consumers who would rather less cost sharing. So no matter what employers do, they're going to step on some of their workers' toes. As Bob and Amy mentioned, we end up encouraging people to obtain more coverage than they would ordinarily, than they would if they were making undistorted decisions undistorted by the tax code. And when we say low-value, they end up purchasing a lot of low-value medical care. What that means is economists have generally found that beyond a certain amount of health insurance, purchasing additional coverage doesn't deliver additional improvements in health. So that's one way of measuring value, but there are other ways that suggest that this excess coverage encourages consumers to purchase too much medical care. It also can create inefficiencies in by distorting people's labor market decisions. If you've ever heard of the term job lock, that's when someone's got an employer-sponsored health insurance plan that they really need because they or someone in their family have a high-cost condition, and they're afraid of moving to another job because that doesn't offer as generous coverage, or they're afraid of retiring early because they would lose access to that coverage. It also creates a lot of inequities, both horizontal and vertical. Now, horizontal inequities are of the form, you've got two neighbors, and they are identical in every way except for one of them works for an employer that offers health insurance and one of them does not. The one that does not ends up paying higher taxes because his health insurance premiums are not tax exempt. So it treats like people differently, but it also creates a lot of people, and there's more controversy about this, a lot of people think it creates vertical inequities. So that because the tax break that comes with the exclusion from employer-sponsored insurance is generally greater for people with higher incomes because they're in higher tax brackets, and that's how deductions work. Whereas people who are in lower tax brackets are if they have employer-sponsored insurance, not only is a tax break not as large, but they're also less likely to work for an employer that offers employer-sponsored health insurance, so they're less likely to get any tax break at all. I think an interesting and underappreciated feature of the exclusion from employer-sponsored insurance is this. If you look at where does the money come from before it enters the hands of a doctor or an insurance company or anyone else operating in the health sector, Almost half of it comes from the government, and over a quarter of it comes from employers, which means that generally employers are the ones controlling how, deciding how that money is used. The consumer share is only about a quarter. It's really less than that because it's that 26% includes things like Medicare Part B premiums, where the consumer doesn't really have much of a choice about how to spend that. Also, the employee portion of their employer-sponsored insurance premiums, where they don't really have much of a choice of how to spend that if what they want is insurance. Because, as I said, if they decided to buy insurance elsewhere, they could end up spending twice as much for less coverage. So the exclusion actually gives employers a control over a large chunk of what is actually the employee's compensation. This is compensation that the employee earned. The economists tell us that if the employer wasn't providing health insurance, they would have to return that money to the employee in the form of cash wages or other benefits, but likely cash wages. And that's a substantial chunk of earnings that the employer gets to control. And an average family policy offered through an employer costs $12,000. On average, the employer portion of that, and I'll put that in quotation marks, the employer portion of that premium is $9,000. So that's a substantial chunk of money for most families that the employer gets to control. And it's why, if you look at only the private sector, employers control about half of the money that goes into healthcare from private payers. And there are two reasons for that. The first one is the wedge that the exclusion drives between the worker and their earnings. And the second is the fact that by drawing so many people out of the individual health insurance market, it makes that a much thinner market and much less attractive to people who might like to purchase insurance that meets their own needs. So we've talked a little bit about some of the possible reforms. One of them is to what was the up and down? Is leveling, that's right. There's leveling up and leveling down. Limiting health-related tax breaks would be leveling down. And there are a couple of ways to do this. You can cap the exclusion so that if you have a family policy where the premium is $12,000 and we place a cap of $6,000 on the exclusion, then the worker would have to pay taxes on the $6,000 that exceed that cap. You could also eliminate the exclusion, which by itself would be a large tax increase because you'd be taxing a lot of previously untaxed activity. So usually when people talk about eliminating the exclusion, they talk about reducing marginal tax rates so that it would be revenue neutral. You could also expand health-related tax breaks, and health savings accounts did that. Actually, they've done it twice so far by creating this tax-free account for you get a tax break for money that the consumer controls. And again, by raising the allowed contributions to health savings accounts, I think they did this in 2006, and they really ramped up the amount of money that people can put into a health savings account tax-free. And both of those expanded the health-related tax breaks. Another option has been proposed in a book by, I think it was, you published that, right, Bob? It was Kogan, Hubbard, and Kessler?
Yeah.
Full deductibility of all health spending. And this, here I do mean deductibility. They propose allowing individuals to deduct from their income taxes every dollar that they spent on health insurance premiums and every dollar that they spend on medical care out of pocket. Also would expand the tax breaks as they exist. And then there's some hybrid approaches such a, that would broaden the tax breaks, the existing tax breaks, but still limit them in some way. And those include the tax credits that Senator McCain has proposed and the standard health insurance deduction that the president proposed. I want to throw out on the table another option that actually builds on health savings accounts. This falls into the third hybrid category. And what it would do is it would, like the others, expand the tax breaks but still cap them at the same time. And so over time, it would limit these tax breaks relative to what they are under current law. I call this option large health savings accounts, and you'll see why. Essentially, it would change health savings accounts, or I should say build on health savings accounts in the following three ways, and it would be a replacement for the exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance. First, it would essentially triple the HSA contribution limits. You can see what they are now, and I talk about tripling them to $8,000 or $16,000 for individuals and families, respectively. Those aren't magical numbers, but there are reasons why I chose those, and for political reasons, they might need to be higher or lower, but we'll just talk about those. The second thing it would do to health savings accounts is remove the insurance requirement. Right now, you can only put money in an HSA tax-free if you have a qualified high-deductible health insurance plan. And there are reasons for removing the insurance requirement that I will get to. And third is allow people to purchase insurance from any source, any type of insurance from any source, with their tax-free HSA funds. Currently, you can only use HSA funds for insurance premiums under limited circumstances. But before I get to what they would do, how would large health savings accounts work? For the most part, workers could take 100% of the money that they currently deduct from, that they currently exempt from income and payroll taxes as a tax-free large health savings account contribution. So that family that is that has a $12,000 policy through their employer could put the $9,000 that their employer was paying into a large health savings account, and they could put the $3,000 that they put in, and they wouldn't, their taxes would not go up. They could even put in another $4,000. And they could adjust that as they can with flexible spending accounts right now. And as I mentioned, they could purchase insurance from any source or no insurance, and there are people who would not be able to arrange the sort of payroll deduction that makes it really easy to exempt contribution HSA contributions from payroll taxes. There's a way to give those people an equivalent tax break. The president laid that out when he proposed his standard health insurance deduction. So if we made these three changes, how would that change the tax treatment of employer-sponsored health insurance? Well, you remember the three price distortions that I mentioned earlier. It would completely eliminate the second three. It would retain a distortion between health and non-health uses of income, but it would, because you would get that tax break for putting money aside for your health care needs, but it would eliminate the price distortions between third-party insurance and saving, and it would eliminate any distortion between consumers' decisions to purchase employer-sponsored insurance or insurance from another source. And as I mentioned, it would broaden and cap the tax breaks. And if those contributions, because it would cap them because those contribution limits would effectively act as a cap on what is currently an unlimited exclusion. And if those were held constant in nominal terms, or even in real terms, those contribution limits, then that would reduce the tax break over time. A couple of things that health savings accounts would achieve is that they would allow people to purchase the mix of insurance and or arrange the mix of insurance and saving that is right for them. It would allow them to purchase the type of insurance that meets their needs, and this is a nice little alphabet soup that probably only the health people in the room will get. It will allow them to choose between high-deductible health plans or health plans with lower deductibles, health maintenance organizations, preferred provider organizations, fee-for-service, or prepayment, just two different ways of paying doctors. And because it's likely that when people are facing trade-offs, when people are actually facing the cost of the premiums that they are purchasing, they're more likely to reduce their consumption of health insurance, reduce the amount of health insurance they purchase, which would reduce the consumption of the low-value care that we mentioned before. It would also reduce labor market distortions because if there's a level playing field for individual insurance, then fewer people will be stuck in jobs because they are unable to because their insurance will stay with them from job to job. In terms of horizontal equity, it would eliminate the tax penalty on people that is currently imposed on people who don't get employer-sponsored insurance. So people will no longer be penalized based on their place of employment or on the quantity or source of insurance coverage, the quantity of coverage they purchase or where they purchase it. In terms of vertical equity, a little less clear, but I would argue that that for those who are very concerned about vertical equity, that large health savings accounts would be an improvement. First, they would cap the exclusion so that the wealthy that everyone's concerned about taking advantage of these large tax breaks for health insurance would be able to do that to a lesser extent. And because it would extend a tax break to low-income workers, and it would extend a tax break to low-income workers who currently get none. And importantly, I think something to keep in mind about every proposal to reform the tax code, the tax treatment of health insurance, almost every proposal, focuses on providing a different tax break for health insurance. Now, what does that mean if you're uninsurable? Well, if you're only providing a tax break for health insurance, then people who are uninsurable don't get any tax break. This is true of the president's proposal for a standard health insurance deduction, proposals to cap the exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance, McCain's tax credit proposal. One benefit of a large health savings account approach is that it actually provides a tax break for health savings rather than health insurance, so that the uninsurable can get a tax break, the same tax break that people who are insurable can get. And let's get to the next slide. And I also think that it would be a more feasible way of capping the exclusion than most of the other proposals that we've seen. One of the obstacles that keeps getting in the way of reforming the tax treatment of health insurance is that they all involve placing, I think, yes, they pretty much all involve taxing previously untaxed economic activity. The way health savings accounts deal with this is, as I mentioned, they would let almost all workers get the same tax break that they are currently getting. This chart shows a cumulative distribution of how much of their earnings workers exempted in the form of employer-sponsored health insurance in 2006. Now, what that line, people with self-only coverage, so individuals, and that line at $8,000 represents the proposed large health savings account contribution limit, and you can see that about 97% of all workers exempted less than $8,000 in 2006 in the form of employer-sponsored insurance. So what that means is replacing the current exclusion with large health savings accounts would mean that 97% of workers would see no tax increase. In fact, they may see a tax cut if they wanted to purchase more generous insurance than they get right now. Only 3% of workers would see any possibility of a tax increase in the first year. And I think offsetting that potential tax increase is a tax cut, in the sense that they get control over the first $8,000 of their earnings, which they do not control right now. This is the same chart, but for family coverage, and shows basically the same thing with a contribution limit of $16,000. 97% of workers who currently have employer-sponsored family coverage would see no increase in their taxes. And these are just another two ways of showing the frequency showing the frequency distribution for those with self-only coverage and family coverage. So, as I mentioned, it would also it can be likened to a tax cut even for those people, that 3%, because it gives them more control over the first $8,000 or $16,000 of their spending. And it would also make it easier to move toward a tax system that's completely neutral toward health expenditures. I think I can skip this part. In fact, let me see. Oh, yeah, let me go to the potential negatives. There are some concerns about this. They exist with all forms of tax reform. What's the effect on federal revenues? What are the effects on pooling? And does it encourage, if you level the playing field between employer-sponsored insurance and individual market insurance, will that encourage low-risk people to leave the employer-sponsored pools and therefore increase the premiums that high-cost people in those pools have to pay? Large health savings accounts create a potential problem with regard to free riding, because what if people decide they just don't want to purchase health insurance? And we can talk about that in the question and answer portion if there's any interest. And I'll go ahead and stop there. Thank you very much.
Now we'd like to start the question and answer period. There is a microphone right over there for those of you that have questions. I think since this is the first panel and it's still pretty early in the morning, I will start things off with a question to our panelists, but I'd encourage you to head over to the mic if you have questions. I'm going to start with what I think is perhaps the hardest question,
to answer in this area, or at least one that I certainly struggle with, and is directly related to one of Michael's potential negatives. And that is, to the extent that we either level up or level down, so we eliminate the preference for employer-provided insurance, there's a significant amount of concern that the healthy individuals will exit the employer group. Because if you are healthy, even if you live in a state, well, if you're healthy and you live in a state where insurers are allowed to medically underwrite, you can do better than your employer group premium if we take out the tax preference. So if you're healthy, you can get a better deal elsewhere. The concern is that we will see those healthy individuals leave the risk pool. The only ones that will be left in the employer group market, if there still is one, is the relatively less healthy. Premiums will go up. We'll see, worst case scenario, a collapse of that market. So I'd be interested in hearing either of our panelists talk about that issue, kind of how do we deal with the potential exit of low risks from the group market.
Well, okay, I'll go ahead. Take a crack at it. I think the first thing to recognize is that if that's a problem, it would be a temporary problem. And the reason is that the individual market, and it's too bad that Mark Pauley isn't here because he's really the, I think, the nation's leading expert on what happens in the individual market. The individual market provides a lot of protection for those with high-cost conditions. As long as you purchase insurance when you're still healthy, there's an awful lot of pooling that goes on in the individual market, which means that there's a lot of when you purchase insurance when you're healthy, it generally stays with you when you get a high-cost condition, and but your premiums don't go up according to that condition. You don't get individually underwritten after you purchase the policy. Your premiums only go up with the average of the group. So what ends up happening is what everyone wants to see happen in employer-sponsored insurance is the healthy people end up paying higher premiums than if they were individually underwritten in order to subsidize the sick who end up paying lower premiums than they would if they were individually underwritten. So if when we level the playing field, if there is this problem of healthy people leaving the pools and adverse selection and people with high-cost conditions can no longer obtain insurance, that would be a temporary problem because over time the people who bought insurance in the individual market would have coverage that stays with them when they get a high-cost condition. I think a second thing to keep in mind is that what we're afraid of happening is already happening because people with high-cost conditions are losing their employer-sponsored insurance and they're being left with no insurance. In fact, Mark just had a paper in that was released by Health Affairs, I think it was yesterday, that showed that if you're high cost and you have individual insurance, you're much less likely to become uninsured than if you are high cost and have insurance through a small employer. Now, though, having said those two things, it is still an issue. It's an issue that we have to deal with. But I recommend that we allow insurance markets to cover as many people as they can, and then try to subsidize those who can't get health insurance in a way that doesn't undermine what insurance markets are able to do.
I would agree with Mike's assessment. I mean, my view is that the employment sector has built up over like 60 years. I mean, you can change policy, I guess, how drastic you do it, but politically, I'm thinking whatever you could ever get through is going to be relatively modest, some kind of tax cap or something like that. And then what you would do is give, as I tried to say in my talk, I think if you could imagine a world like that, all the companies would be able to offer their employees a choice. If you want to, by the way, I was thinking about those 2.5% that were up at the end of your distribution, they're almost all in the United Auto Workers. Yeah. But those are the people that are really have the most elaborate, expensive plans in the country. But the company could give an option to the people, say, look, if you keep this expensive policy, I'm going to have to report the additional amount as taxable income, and you're going to have to pay taxes on it. And some people may choose to do that. But if the company could offer them a plan saying below the cap, you could avoid the tax. If the company only wanted to offer one option, they could redesign the plan to get it under there, just a little more cost sharing or, you know, a little bit more controls on the, on what they pay for. I think they could easily get the premiums under the cap. And then you get the issue, do you need some sort of regulatory requirement that everybody in the firm has to be covered? In other words, you wouldn't let the healthy people just drop out of the firm. I mean, the company might have that policy. I don't know whether you need federal regulation about that, but that will be, I think, an issue. Let me also say that if you could get this redesign, it seems to me that you would actually give more alternatives to the small business community. When you look at the statistics on the uninsured, a lot of those people are really working for people, for companies that don't offer health insurance. And so if the small business community had more options to buy more cost-effective insurance and so on, then I think you could actually reduce the number of uninsured. But again, you probably have, like Mike said, you probably have to figure out some way to give some sort of income-based subsidy to individuals as opposed to now doing it the way we do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I really liked your proposals for the probably discretionary spending and also probably preventive health care spending, but I was wondering if you had any proposals to address two large issues that I think were not addressed, the gigantic bureaucracy of paperwork that all the insurance creates. You know, I've heard a statistic that is 50% of all health care costs, and also the catastrophic health care costs. I've heard one statistic said 80% of all health care costs is spent on the catastrophic at the end of life.
Well, I'll go first on this one, Mike. There is a some sort of hard-to-find discussions of the administrative cost issue. It comes up a lot in sort of international debates, you know, about comparing the U.S. to Canada and other kinds of places. And people have a lot of funny statistics about, you know, what it costs to administer our system. There are several writers, a good analyst, I think, that think this is kind of a false issue, that a lot of it has to do with what you count in the administrative cost in the other, or what you don't count in when you compare it to other countries. I don't know that that it's that much of a problem. Also, the catastrophic coverage, it's right, the distribution, a lot of the money goes to expensive kinds of things, but that's what you buy insurance for. And so if the insurance companies had an incentive to try to control that or put more effort into defining what works for the high-end problem, you know, like the chronically ill and those kinds of things, I think we need a lot more research about what works there, but I don't see why those couldn't be incorporated into the insurance contract in a way that would improve the efficiency of the high-cost care.
I've seen different estimates of how much health spending in the United States goes toward administrative costs. I've seen 50%. I've seen 30%. I don't trust any of them, really. Because of, you know, these counting issues and nor the comparisons between public and private. But let me say this about administrative costs. When you've got two people spending a third person's money, that third person is going to spend a lot of money to make sure that they're spending that wisely. And that's where the administrative costs come from. If you have one person who's spending his own money, then the administrative costs are usually much lower. So I think that the fact that the tax code as well as federal entitlement programs have led to so much, incurred so much excessive third-party payment is probably the biggest driver of administrative costs in the U.S. With regard to catastrophic costs, I've Did you say 80% in the last 6 months? That's I think it's a much smaller. It's a much smaller amount, and mostly that's Medicare spending. But that is why you buy insurance, and yet there are a lot of indications that what people that a lot of the catastrophic spending isn't doing anything to produce any better health outcomes, and it isn't producing or isn't making patients any happier. So you've got all that, let's call it waste out there. How do you get rid of it? There are basically two ways. You can make the consumer more cost conscious so that they say no more often to what the doctor recommends. Or you can let the insurance company make those decisions. And so you're talking about basically cost sharing or managed care. And as I said, when people are pushed into either of those options, they don't like being pushed. And so people resist when you try to reduce when you try to reduce cost by pushing people into greater cost sharing or greater care management. But if you let people choose those options on their own, guided by market prices, in other words, health insurance premiums, then the people who prefer managed care are going to go to those plans. And the research on people who choose, HMOs, shows that they actually like it. If they prefer not to have an insurance company telling them what they can and cannot get, well, they can pay higher premiums or they can have more cost sharing, and then they can make those decisions themselves. I think that's the way to get at administrative and catastrophic costs.
Could I just add one thing I forgot to say, just to refer you to the most recent study. If you look for a paper by June and Dave O'Neill on the, it's an NBER working paper at the present time.
All right, since there's no one else at the microphone, I'm going to go ahead and ask another one of my, what I think are tough questions here. I think it's fair to say that both of our panelists today are interested in greater cost sharing with respect to health care, that there's a well-known economic problem that if you have generous insurance coverage, you don't spend money very wisely because it's someone else's money. So there are good economic arguments there. But we also have some evidence with respect to personal bankruptcies that many people go into bankruptcy as a result of medical bills that are relatively small, $500, that this is either a primary or main contributing factor to a personal bankruptcy. And that's not surprising given what we know about Americans' amount of debt and rates of savings. So how do we reconcile those two things, right? Understanding the economic argument about wanting people to be better medical consumers and therefore impose greater cost sharing with the fact that many Americans simply don't have savings to cover higher cost sharing. Be curious about either one of your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm kind of ambivalent about the amount of cost sharing that that consumers face when they go to the doctor, go to the hospital. I'm very interested in making sure they control every one of the dollars that purchases their health insurance, because they can buy insurance they want, and that's going to decide how much, and they can decide how much cost sharing they're going to face. And it'll probably result in more cost sharing, and I think that'll like I've said before, not have any appreciable effect on overall health outcomes. As for medical bankruptcies, there's a big debate over how many medical bankruptcies are a result of people, of the medical bills that people face. I think usually it's a problem because people don't have health insurance. I hadn't heard of $500 medical debts causing bankruptcies, but there are indications that a lot of the money, maybe as much as a third of the money that we spend on healthcare in the U.S. is wasted on care that doesn't provide much value. If we give consumers more of an incentive to find those, to gravitate to plans that eliminate that sort of waste, it's going to save them money, and I don't think it's unreasonable to think that it might help hold down premiums to, the extent of $500 or something like that. I think, though, the bigger problem with regard to bankruptcies is probably that people don't have insurance, and so I think just reforming the tax code in a way that makes insurance more accessible to people who don't get those tax breaks right now is probably going to do or make a big dent in that bankruptcy problem.
Well, let me add. Cost sharing might work. We have evidence that it does affect people's choices and so on. But as an economist, what I would imagine in a more competitive market, if you had some sort of limit on the tax exclusion, that you would have strong incentives, as I said before, to redesign these plans, and that would cause them to be more effective. But what you would really have is an incentive to redesign them, and the people doing that would have strong incentives to do more research, to do sort of practical business research types of things about what works. And you could imagine somebody say, well, a little more cost sharing in the plan, you know, that would, we could reduce the premiums. That's one way. But you could also go contract with the Mayo Clinic or, you know, the meanest HMO you can find and say, there's no cost sharing here, but you're going to be covered by a bunch of people who are going to question everything that, that you do and the doctor does. And by the way, this is evidence-based. We're going to put a lot of emphasis on sort of doing what works and not doing the things that waste money. Now, you can imagine that as an option in the marketplace. Is that going to sell? Are people going to like it? It may be that you will have somebody, we're the less mean HMO out there, you know, and they're going to market themselves as, well, we're a little more relaxed about this, and you have it, but you're going to, it's going to cost you more. You might even have to pay some taxes on it if it gets over the cap. So, but the point is, let the market figure out these various kinds of things, you know, what's efficient.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I have a question for Mr. Cannon, and I apologize for making you go over this again, but I'm not sure I fully understood how your proposal concerning health savings accounts improved.
Then I should apologize.
But
no, I should apologize.
No, there was a lot of information, and I'm not familiar with all the lingo. How it improves vertical equity. As I understand the vertical equity problem, it is that a tax exclusion or a flexible spending exclusion is more valuable to somebody with higher income than it is with someone to lower income. I don't, and if someone is receiving employer-sponsored insurance, that's true. The tax exclusion is more valuable to the higher income than to the lower income person who works for the same employer. How does health savings account change that?
Health savings, the proposal that I was talking about, expanding health savings accounts into large health savings accounts.
I mean,
There are two ways you can remedy a vertical equity problem. You can either level down or level up. You can take away some of the benefit that the wealthy people are getting, or give some benefit to the people, the lower income people. What large HSAs would do is right now the exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance is uncapped. So there were people, I think in my chart.
It's just the cap that improves vertical equity. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, no. I'm sorry. At the high end. It's the cap that improves vertical equity by limiting the amount that the wealthy can exempt from their taxes.
Although if the UAW workers are the main people who are going to be hurt by that, one would suggest that perhaps it would exacerbate rather than improve vertical equity.
Those are premiums, and premiums do not necessarily correlate with income. Because you could have moderate income people with very high premiums because they're in a very sick group. But I think the bigger way that it gets at the vertical equity problem is that it provides a tax break to people who don't currently get it, the uninsured who are disproportionately low income and working for small businesses.
But
it gives them a substantial tax break that they currently don't get.
Right. But I would just refer to workers.
Any uninsurable as well,
right.
Wherever.
Right. So people who are currently seriously harmed by the current system would improve the equity.
Right.
But that's true of high income and low income people. Because there may be high income people who are also not covered by the and the situation I was talking about is the high income worker and low income worker working for the same employer, not really much difference in the vertical equity problem through health savings account reform.
Not necessarily. And here's why. That low income worker could have higher medical bills and yet maybe they don't get as much coverage as they would like, or they don't get to exempt as much from taxes as they would like. That low-income person would be able to exempt more from taxes.
Thank
you. The proposal was not designed to address the vertical equity problem, but I think it does make a dent in that problem.
Okay, I think Lee is standing up to.
I have a question. The title of this panel is Health Care, How Our Tax Laws Affect How Health Care is Paid for and Delivered. And as so often happens when we're talking about this issue, when anybody's talking about this issue, it always devolves to a question of health insurance. And if you look at all the candidates' plans, it's all talking about who's going to pay for the health insurance. And the insurance question merely answers who pays for it and what is the mechanism for the payment. And we've talked about the third-party payor and how that makes the actual consumer of the health care services less cost-conscious about the services that they select. And you mentioned, Robert, taking care about our terms, using the right word, not using the word deduction, but rather using the word exclusion. Well, another way of providing health care, or wondering how is the health care going to be paid for, the Internal Revenue Code also provides a tax exemption for hospitals. And it has been much in the news in the last few years that some tax-exempt hospitals are not really providing a lot of charity care for members of their communities who might be deserving it. Now, this might be a little out of your realm, but I wondered if you could comment on that, on the role of tax exemptions for hospitals in providing health care, because, again, insurance is just who's going to pay for it. And the question that I really would like also addressed is how can health care be made as universally available as possible?
There's a debate over just how much charitable care we're getting for that tax deduction that we give to nonprofit hospitals. A lot of nonprofit hospitals say a lot of researchers say no, the nonprofits and for-profits generally provide the same amount of uncompensated or charitable care. And Bob, correct me if I've got this wrong. You know, my preference is that is for a tax code that raises revenue for the government and does as little distorting of people's decisions and process as possible. And so if what you want to do is subsidize something, I think it's much better to have a transparent subsidy program than to try to do that through the tax code. But, Bob, I don't know if you have anything to add about it.
Well, there is a literature on this. Not that I keep up with it all that well, but I think Mike is right. You know, you could imagine, you know, that it does to start some incentive. So you've got this debate going about whether we get anything. But let me just mention, looking at the history of health insurance, when the American Hospital Association began to organize these prepayment plans that were emerging in different markets, they typically went to the state legislature and got special enabling legislation passed in every state that gave them, they had to be nonprofits, they had restrictions about how they could pay and so on. But basically, commercial insurance came along later, but they were, what this special legislation did was exempt the Blues from the premium taxes imposed by the state. So there are major differences also in state tax policy having to do with what kind of insurance company you are, not just whether you're a for-profit or non-profit hospital. So that's another distortion in the system.
All right. I think to keep us on schedule, this will have to be our last question.
Hello. My name is Joe Garino. I'm with the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. We're a community of Christians who share each other's medical bills without insurance. And so my question to you is, as we're looking at leveling the playing field for those who have employer-sponsored insurance with pre-tax dollars and those who have private insurance with after-tax dollars, how do you envision including all of us folks who don't use insurance but yet still pay our medical bills, which is what all public policy folks are looking for?
Well, I'm trying to figure out whether you are insurance or not.
We are not
providing insurance.
Matter of fact, we have a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court that says we're not insurance.
Okay. I think that the tax code should raise revenue for the government, and if you're going to have a tax code, it should raise revenue for the government and not encourage people to do this or that, give them a sugar pill or an electric shock if they do the right or the wrong things. And so there shouldn't be any distortions between paying for health insurance out of pocket yourself or paying for health care out of pocket yourself through health insurance or through some non-insurance group, some civic association like the one that you formed. I think that I think probably only the large health savings account approach or maybe the Kogan-Hubbard-Kessler full deductibility approach would level the playing field for you. And no, only health savings accounts or getting rid of all tax breaks, and large health savings accounts or getting rid of all tax breaks entirely would remove the penalties, the tax penalties that you face right now.
All right, thank you very much.